Hey everybody, this is Mark here. Thanks again for coming back to another episode of FMA Talk Live. You can check us out at fmatalklive.com, also on Facebook, FMA Talk Live, and follow us on Twitter at FMA Talk Live. So this week we are joining myself, Guru John Bednarski, and Master Rich Parsons, who's going to talk to us about his glory days of training Blintawak and Modern Arnis, and also what he's doing now and in the future in 2016. So enjoy, and if you have any questions, please give us a message on Facebook, or you can also email us at fmatalklive@gmail.com. Thanks.
Well, I first started with Modern Arnis back in 1986. A friend of mine introduced me as a stress reliever to burn off some worry, anxiety, and so forth. I was a person of interest for a self-defense situation.
Oh, that sounds that sounds ominous. Person of interest.
Yes, unfortunately, someone did get stabbed. I wasn't the person who did the stabbing or got stabbed, but I was a key material witness, and so.
Oh, so this was a court thing you were pulled into.
Yes.
Oh my gosh! So you were actually a person of interest. Okay. Well, I thought you were. I thought that was like, you know, street slang for some. Okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah, so after, that was ongoing, I got introduced once to a class, and I kept coming back. my first experience of just dealing with weapons and joint locks and moving in non-linear fashions made it interesting. It was good for me because I was able to learn how to not use my Hulk smash strength and able to not break people all the time. I could choose to break them or to place them someplace. So it dealt with weapons. I was bouncing to help pay for college at the time. So, you know, you would see, you know, baseball bats, gloves, you know, wooden backs of cars, and people use the bats as, you know, party favors.
So were you bouncing before you started doing Arnis?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm kind of getting the vibe that you were kind of in a little rough and tumble crowd here and there.
Yes. I actually grew up in a nice sleepy little neighborhood outside of Flint called Grand Blanc.
Oh yeah. Nice and quiet.
Yes, but I hung out as I got in high school in Flint and Flint adjacent areas that weren't always the best. And then when I was in college, I worked at one of the major hangout spots for everybody from the ages of 12 to 45 for video arcades, go-karts, bumper boats, you know. And I also did security at bars even before I was 21. Because, you know, they didn't care if I could drink or not. They just wanted to make sure I could check IDs and stop other people from doing that. So, yes, it wasn't necessarily where I worked wasn't bad. Where I lived was very nice. It was safe, sound, sleepful, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the deadly Pac-Man and asteroid crowd, that's the ones you need to worry about.
Well, you know, people think, wow, that's not too dangerous. But then you say, yeah, but when you get the 45-year-olds that come through drunk and they think they can do whatever they want because they paid their money to, ride the go-karts, and then you have to say, well, gee, you ran a little kid off and threw the tires because the first guy cleared the path and then two of you pushed him off and pushed the go-kart into the water. So that's $3,000. So I'm going to give you $20 and drive your brand new $20,000 Buick LeSabre around the parking lot. And all the people I run over and run into and crash is going to be your responsibility to fix. And then they would be like, it would start to sink in a little bit at that point, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, during the day, it was no big deal. At night, particularly weekends, you would get into a lot more. I cleaned it up, so there wasn't as much, you know, drugs and other things in the parking lot. And, of course, I made enemies with some of the local gangs. So when they found out I didn't care if they showed up and spent money, mm-hmm. they just couldn't show up and claim it was their territory.
Yeah,
But that's total sidetrack for the FMA community.
Oh, that's all right. You're starting your early political career. I like it.
So, but yes, I was, you know, in FMA with Remy Priestess in the Flint community for a very long time. And
what year was that? That was
1986 is when I actually got introduced.
That was delayed. So, okay, so when you started Arnis, it was with Professor Priestess?
There was a local group here. Some of the names were like Joe Doris, Jim Power, Jeff Owen. Real old school names for Mount Arnis from the 70s.
Yeah, wow. All right.
Okay, so, you know, I wasn't necessarily, you know, straight under him until a little bit later when we all tested for black belt, and then we would train semi-private seminars in the Flint area with him through late 80s, early 90s, mid-90s, which then leads me to we started getting some of our members into training with Manon Ted. Jim Power started in January of 96. Then a couple of other people from our club got in early 97. And then I was able to join in early 98 just because he was still working as an engineer and he had a limited number of slots that he did for private lessons. So,
okay. And did you know about Anselm Bacon and that kind of legacy of Blintawak and everything before you started working with Manung Ted?
Yes and no. A couple of conversations with Remy Priestess was like, oh, bright-eyed, young, 20-year-old, you're the best stick fighter in the world. Nope, was Remy's comment. I know a couple of people that are better than me, you know, and I'm like, really? He goes, stick fighter. Now, overall, weapons guys, he's like, because there's some Blintawak guys out there that are really good with their stick. And I'm like, and he had a lot of Blintawak training as well. So he gave credit to Ted and Anshon and a few others, okay? So at that point, it also opened my eyes to, oh, wow, you can be really good, be a really good teacher, and it doesn't have to be that it's all about you and you're number one. There can be other number ones in different areas, or we're all close and it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated that. From a logical and ethical standpoint, it was very nice. But yeah, so I kind of knew that Anshon had been one of Remy's teachers. I knew that he had been influential in his forming of Mon and Arnis, but I didn't know a lot of details. Our group had sparred in the late 80s. One of the other Blintawak groups down in the Detroit area that was a student of Ted's. And our guys did quite well. So we were known for rough and tumble, like a few other FMA schools around, particularly like Buffalo, with Hartman's group. They just did Modern Arnis. That's what Flint did. They just did Mon Arnis. So it wasn't like they did some other art and added this on once a week. This was the only system these guys trained in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they may have started somewhere else, but then they had switched over to just working this one system. So once we started with TED, and then TED Blue Eyes, we would work as a group up in Flint. So even before I started actual training with TED, we were going over some singles and some concepts as a group from the early students that were attending with him, my peers and the club as well. And as we got a chance to practice, and some people will say, well, Rich, why were you able to pick it up, you know, and why do some people say, you know, you're one of the top leading technical people at his organization, or our group, I should say, because it really wasn't that large to be an organization. And I say, well, a lot of it has to do with just practice. And they're like, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, Sunday night we had a two-hour class, and we'd spend at least half that time working on our blimp a lot. All right. So about an hour on Sunday night. Monday night was my review night from what I had done Sunday night, and also my prep for my private on Tuesday. Okay. On Tuesday, I'd have my hour-long class with Manunted in the afternoon, and then I would go back to work, and then I would work on it that night, either things that we'd found that I needed more work on or the new techniques he was showing me. And then Wednesday night, I would teach the hour-long class, and I would implement as much time and cross over into the Modern Arnis as I could with the blunt walk. And then Thursday night, I'd usually take off. Friday night, I'd go train with other people in town who were students of NunTed, but who weren't necessarily part of the Flint group. And then Saturday, I'd usually hook up with somebody and practice something anyway. So I had one night off.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, if you're doing that for, how many years were you doing that for, months or?
Well, from 98 till 2005 when he had a stroke.
That's a ton. I mean, you're doing anything like that, you're gonna become very, very proficient and technical with that amount of practice. Especially right. If you're teaching it to other people as well, probably. I mean, you're both, you know, passing techniques that you've learned back and forth and all that. I mean, that's the way everybody kind of, or at least a lot of people. I know I learn things faster if I show somebody that technique or whatever, you know.
It makes you formulate it in your mind.
Yeah.
You have to stress it. You have to be able to do it properly. And you say, oh, my feet weren't right. My hips weren't right. My weight wasn't right. So therefore, you have to, like, you know, make sure your demonstration is correct. Yes, it does help when you try to present it or show it or teach it to others.
So now, go ahead, Josh.
I'm training with my aunt, Ted. You know, was in the beginning, was it kind of, for lack of a better term, was it kind of a little bit of a shock and difference between blimp walk and Modern Arnis that you already knew at that time period, or were you already eased into that transition because other people in the club had been training with Manon Ted?
It wasn't that large of a transition. The blocks I got in early 86, were very similar to the blimp lock block. So it wasn't a push block. It was the hard, you know, hammer fits down, but the force of the stick was coming out, force-to-force blocks. And so those types of concepts, the weight positioning was a little bit different, but I went in with a complete empty mind and said, it's a different system. There are multiple ways to solve the same problem, so I'm going to learn this way, and approached it from that aspect from day one. Others said, well, yeah, Rich, you're an engineer. You can set things aside. You can look at it logically, and that might be true. And might be my philosophical beliefs of just, you know, keep an open mind and being tolerant and listening and learning from people, or it might be a combination thereof. Or I might be obsessive compulsive. You never know.
So when training with Mom Ted, was your training then primarily scenario-based in the beginning when it came to actually working with techniques, or did he actually have a set curriculum into how he would work you through the methods that were taught?
You first learn how to strike, where your weight was, even how to hold the stick so that your ligaments in your arm weren't stressed. You would work on weight positioning, and then you get into your what was a abecedario, which is, you know, the instructor is striking 1 through 12, and the student is blocking into his forearm and doing a counter strike to his head, keeping the stick 90 degrees to your forearm, which forces you to do more body mechanics of turning your knee and hips to get the proper positioning of the target. And this is a trust exercise as well to keep you going slow, so therefore you don't go ballistic and realize, oh, while I'm learning, I need to just move slow, because he's not blocking. He's just allowing you to target your stick within an inch to 2 inches of his temple. And then as you get a little bit better with that, he then changes it to he's striking with the belly of the cane versus his puño, full forearm, and you start working on blocking that. And then the next step is seguidas, which is where you basically do the same blocks and the same strikes, but they're out of order. And then once you start learning from the belly, then he'll move out to the tip of the cane, and then you start realizing, oh, distancing is very important. So then we start working on things like leaning. So you don't have to step to address the distance. You can body shift or lean, depending upon the terminology that other systems use. You can, from there, he works on specific singles, and I coined the term baby curatus. He used the term curatus, which was like a mixing bowl. But while you're learning these new techniques, and he had the semi-set curriculum, it'd be like a group of 6-7 techniques. Didn't matter which of the 7 you learned first, just you had to learn this group of techniques.
Okay.
And then while you worked on those, you'd go in seguidas, and then you break out of seguidas for that one move, and then fall right back into seguidas. So therefore, you're continuing the flow mindset of always countering, always having yourself be countered, and continuing to move and defend yourself.
Yeah, that's the one thing I love about, you know, the Balintawak mindset, and, you know, those that counter for counter. You know, so I work, we train under Yuli Romo, and, you know, he's a Balintawak guy as well. And he, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, he incorporates into BZ is that, you know, that counter for counter mindset, and that when you're in close and how to transition from one to the other. And, you know, I love that being able to set up strategies from, you know, A to be able to understand where C is going to come from. You know, it's like being able to kind of move through the strategy of the strikes and in your movement.
Right. And which gets to the what a lot of people consider the last stage. You know, after baby curatus, you're in full curatus. And then there's kind of like your advanced curatus, where you're learning lances and you're setting people up with single type baiting situation. But the actual last one is quintada, which basically means counting. So you're kind of counting coup on the person, because you're guiding them to where you want them so you can get the strike you are looking for.
Okay.
And so some organizations look at it like a level. From the NUNCTAD and my understanding, it's not necessarily a level, because you could be, an early person in Caritas and walk in somebody straight off the streets and has no clue how to swing a stick or defend themselves. And you could swing at them and they could try to block, and you can counter and swing the other side and hit them, and that was your intent. So technically you quintada'd them, but you're not doing it against anybody who has any skill sets, right? So it's a concept that can be applied across a long range of personal skill sets. It doesn't necessarily mean that once you're able to do it, you're able to beat everybody. It just means, oh, look, that's what they mean. I like the idea of being able to set people up, guide them to the technique. One of the big things from NUNCTAD's lineage is the left hand is the quarterback and is actually the one that sets almost all the striking, single strikes up. It manages, monitors, and delays. So while their stick is riding in the webbing of your hand, you're monitoring them. Oh. And then while you just move your hand, that does your management. You can snake around and curl as needed. And then if they try to, like, go straight down against your thumb, then that delays them. If they try to go up against your fingers and hand pad, then that delays them. If they try to draw through, well, that means a long draw, so that will delay them. So your only quick option or on-time option is to withdraw and rechamber the stick, which, you know, might put you on the same, you know, timing as them, 50-50 again, but that's okay. You're not behind, right?
Okay.
So some people like the grab, and they think the grabs counter a lot of things, and they do, and they can slow people down or break their timing. But if you know the counters to the grabs, then, you know, it puts you at a disadvantage, and then they're able to use that, your disadvantage, to their advantage and counter you. Does it take a little bit better skill set to counter the grabs than it does to grab? Yes. So if you are a beginner to intermediate or even semi-advanced, you can definitely grab and beat tons of the people out there and make it work and execute decent techniques. But you're limiting your techniques and you're opening yourself up to certain counters if the person is listening to their own stick. And the energy that you give somebody when you grab them versus just touching them is a lot, I'll say, louder. It's easier to read, understand.
That term monitoring, is that something that you got from NUNCTAD, or is that kind of something that's in the Blintawak vocabulary?
It's kind of from NUNCTAD. NUNCTAD would, Enchan taught, and he taught at different various places, including his shack, you know, and of the house, as it was described to me. And then he also taught at the watch shop that people semi-related to him owned and operated, and they trained in the back, basically like the small backyard, which might be the size of somebody's large living room, right?
Okay.
NUNCTAD was the only one of his students who taught at that school when Enchan wasn't there. Okay. Now, it doesn't mean that the other groups didn't have their own schools, weren't teaching up their own. This goes back to some of the old school mindset, particularly from Enchan. If you want to go teach, fine. If somebody comes and challenges you or checks you out, you got to defend yourself, right? So this means no disrespect to anybody else when I say those statements, because they may not have been interested in teaching because they had their own schools in different districts or outlying areas. So sometimes when Untad would be teaching, Anton would walk in, he'd hand him the stick, he'd teach for a while. When he was tired, he'd hand the stick back to Untad. Untad would just continue teaching, and Noy Anchan would go ahead and leave and go home and take care of his personal life as he saw fit. Now, one of the things I did discuss is you've heard some subliminal terms that I've mentioned. There's others like certain techniques are takas and sublime, but then another technique would be called like limbo or high chair, and you know, or Macarena or something like that.
Okay.
And yeah, you end up pinning them with their arms crossed across their own chest. So
nice.
That's why he called it Macarena. And I was like, okay, all right.
Oh, that's funny. Well,
when he left the Philippines, he had a certain set of terms that were already in the Cebuano or Brazilian. And now when he came to the States and he needed a new word, many times he started coining English terms or English phrases. So when somebody from a different lineage goes, I don't know what limbo is, or I'm like, and you shouldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you might do the technique, you just don't know that that's what we call it.
Well, because that's the funny thing too. There's, you know, when you start researching and talking to like a lot of the old masters, and you start kind of learning some of the heuristics or whatever of the different terminology and everything, it's like a lot of times it's literally just, the old man liked that word, or yeah, that made sense at the time. And, you know, it's not like there's universal terms for everything in Arnis, because it's just, it's so regional. And then it's, you know, based on the personality of the teacher. So.
Correct. And, you know, like some of the discussions I've had online, people are like, Wikipedia, it's all about the grouping thing. And I will go add a paragraph and say, for historical references only, Anchan taught an ungrouped methodology, and Untad continues to teach that way, and so does his students. Then he adds the phrase, there's a few of us who do it, and there's a much larger number who are teaching the grouping methodology. Make your own assumptions about the practicality of reaching larger numbers with the different teaching methodologies. And all of a sudden, they would leave my paragraph in because it's an appropriate plug to say, yeah, the grouping methodology from a different lineage was able to reach a much larger group versus having to teach everybody one-on-one in single format, right? Mm-hmm. So, some of those discussions has happened, and when people realize, like, oh, you're not taking away from us, you're just documenting. And I'm like, yes. And you're still giving respect to Bobby and Nick and others who, you know, are teaching from the group of methodology, particularly from Velez. Then you go say, yes. And you go, yeah, great. Understand there's differences. Somebody said, well, you know, Anchan taught Abenicos. And I said, no, Anchan didn't teach Abenicos. He didn't like Abenicos, and he didn't do Sinwalis. Both Remy and Ted made that comment. And they were like, oh. I said, but, you know, Grandmaster Bobby Tabuada teaches them, yes. So obviously he likes them, yes. So either he put them in or his instructor put them in. I have no problem with it. That's their organization. That's what they want to do. It doesn't take away from anything else that they're teaching, right? And it also shows you how other people move. So maybe they use it as, oh, when people do this, this is our counters, right? So, you know, back in the early aughts when I was having some internet discussions with people. I got some phone calls from some went on Bobby's people saying he wanted to meet me. And I was like, okay. And, you know, I said, so is this a friendly meeting where we'll be drinking a beer, iced tea, lemonade, or is this one where he's going to hand me a stick and show me the errors of my face? And so they were like, they all laughed and they said, nope, you're absolutely right. He just wants to chat with a lemonade. Okay. I said, okay. And I go, I wasn't expecting, but if he wants to correct me that way, I'll listen, and but I want to know so I can do my best, right? And so therefore, I can say, yep, that definitely worked, and I was wrong, or this is what I meant when I said this. And later, unfortunately, I wasn't able to meet him. Then I met him a few years later, and I wouldn't say we are best friends, but I would say we are friends. And we were both at the Blintlock gathering on the East Coast this last summer. And he took some time to talk to me one-on-one, told me some of his interactions with Remy, and gave me some additional history, just chatting and sharing with me. So I very much appreciated his knowledge and his experience and perspective and those aspects as well. But the person who called me and said, yeah, I can tell you've trained with old school Filipinos because, you know, you were wondering if I'm calling you out or having calling you out on half of Bobby. And I'm like, yeah, if it's true, then okay, I'll either apologize or take my lumps as how I feel. But, you know, so Bobby kind of appreciated my comments as well. So that's why I think he wanted to meet me. So,
yeah.
Usually I'm not abrasive, but sometimes people can misunderstand what your meaning is. And so I wanted to make sure. One of the things that we learned back to the curriculum questions since we meandered off, there is no absolute set curriculum through the creative process of you must learn this before that. There are certain techniques you have to know the timing for other techniques first, or you're just not in the right spot to execute them. So some of it is based upon the student's capability of absorbing certain things before they can move on and learn others. But let's say student J was having a problem with, you know, move X, and they came in and asked a question, then everybody could get a review on move X for that week.
Okay.
So once I figured that out, I always made sure I had my list of personal questions, because he would always start the class with, do you have any questions? And if you had personal questions, he would address those first. And then, if he had time left over or didn't have any, then he would address what was on his mind or on what was, you know, a review based on what was done with others. So I appreciated that mindset. One of the things he did like to do as well was to tell stories as he would try to teach a lesson.
Oh, nice.
And some people got frustrated because they heard the story of a whole lot, and they thought it was a waste of their time.
Oh, so you'd repeat the same stories over and over?
Yes.
Okay. Sounds like my dad.
What?
It sounds like my dad. He had about, you know, 20 or 25 really good stories, and you over the years you got to know them really well.
Well, and I can see that to a point, but I also think there was another lesson in there as well. I don't remember all the stories because I didn't hear all the stories. Some of them I only heard two or three times. And so my belief is that if you had the objective of the story down, he didn't have to retell it to you. So it might have been his way of telling you that you need to practice this.
Ah, okay. I like that. It's kind of sneaky.
Very old school, you know.
I'm going to avoid conflict. I'm going to tell you the story again that this is what you need to work on without telling you you need to work on it.
Yeah, I like that.
One of the stories I remember quite well because it stuck with me because issues that I was having with the Flint group. We were, some of them that started before me, I had some techniques they hadn't seen yet. My timing was a little bit better in certain areas. So it frustrated them. And they would say, well, Manung Ted hasn't taught me this, and I started before you. And I would say, but he taught me this. And I'd say, when? And they'd get frustrated. So one time, though, I said, no, he didn't teach me this move, but he taught me this move over here, and I just applied it somewhere else. And they went, well, you can't do that. And I said, why? They said, well, you got to keep what he's teaching pure. And I said, all right, but he tells a story of, he was working with a guy, and the guy complained to Anchan, who was watching, to that Ted was always able to beat him. And so, particularly on this one move. So Anchan went in and showed him the counter. And then the guy executed the counter on Ted, and Ted blocked it and moved on to the next move. And then this went back and forth with Anchan stepping in for the next three or four moves. And then at the last move there, he walks out, he slaps Ted on the shoulder, and he says, good luck, boy. Because he knew he hadn't taught him the preferred counter to that move yet.
Huh.
So, he took the basics he had and the concepts and the principles, and he executed that and created a block, which may not have been a preferred move to optimize his own personal counters, but it was more of a back to the basics, creating space, getting your block in place, making sure you're at least neutral, and then going from there. And so that story stuck with me. At a certain point, yes, there is no longer a absolute, but it's a application of the summation of what you have learned. Although the negative to that is that if you think you've learned that and comprehended that, and you go off and try to start making up things, you can get yourself into trouble when you train with other people, or if you're training with a small group of people that only move in certain ways, and then you totally forget about how other people might move. That could get you into trouble. And I'll say into trouble meaning defined, hit, hurt, you know what I mean? When you're playing or sparring with someone else.
You're kind of going beyond the limits of your knowledge into kind of that BS land where, you can start kind of getting into the weeds, as they say.
Right, exactly. Now, there was a lock that Manung Ted used. He just called it the trunk up, which is generic for lock. But, he assumed that there was no counter because no one could ever with the appropriate timing, get out of it. I applied a lot of the small circle jiu-jitsu and large circle judo that Remy had from Mata Arnis to that concept, lowered my center, turned my body from the Balintalox point, and was able to execute a counter. Once again, I got in trouble with the group, went to see Nun Ted. He laughed. He said, I like it.
Nice.
He goes, you haven't done anything wrong. And he says, but I would have expected this to come from one of the smaller guys, not from the guy who's 6'3", 280 pounds at the time. So I go, yes, because I had to get my center down below there. So that means I had to drop relatively low. So, you know, there's a positioning from outside influence did affect how he taught, and I could see it over time. I even went back and did a investigation talking to people and how they learned one of the early techniques called sublique, was it palm up or palm down, and somewhere between 95 and 96, January of 95 and January of 96, when Uncle Ted switched from teaching it palm up first to palm down first. And the reason being is that if palm down with the technique, if somebody slaps your hand, you're able to curl your hand in and you're not pinned. If your palm is up, you end up being pinned. So that way it requires a better positioning of distancing and timing to execute. So, you know, a senior could execute it palm up without any problem, but, you know, beginners and intermediates could be countered there easily.
Okay. Just real quick, did you guys use a concept of, like, opposites? So that was one of the things that Master Yuli was big into, was if you have one hand on... Like if you're doing a technique, and let's say your stick hand is on top of your partner's arm, your live hand would be underneath, so it'd be palm up. So if you're palm down in one arm, you'd be palm up in the other, whatever technique you're doing. So we always had this it was this concept of opposite. So if you had one hand forward, the other one would be back, kind of that type of thing.
It wasn't called up directly. There are a lot of moves that do execute that way.
Okay.
But there were some that don't. So I think that's maybe why Ted didn't teach it specifically that way.
Yeah.
But no, I see the one of the things he did speak of would be, well, there's Juanito and another Mark, or in my case, he said Rich, and I'd be like, okay. I'd be like, well, Juan is just somebody. It could be anybody off the street, maybe trained in some totally different art, right? So they're going to move one hand at a time. They're going to move out of sync. They're not going to be very coordinated. They're not going to have a lot of skill set. So certain techniques will work very well against Juan. Other techniques you'll never get into with Juan because he never presses you or pushes you into those positions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Then you got Juanito, somebody who knows a little bit more, could even know some of your system or be a cousin. But they may still be moving one hand at a time versus both hands at a time. And then, so the techniques will work against them, and others won't, depending upon positioning and timing. And then there's that other Mark. He knows everything that Mark knows, but one move, and that crazy guy won't tell Mark what it is. So Mark's got to be completely aware, ready to abort, and ready to block and counter everything and anything, because you never know when that other Mark that you're facing is what is going to pull that one new move out.
Yeah.
And so if you assume that everybody you're playing with or sparring or working or fighting against is that other mark, then you assume that they're always going to be one more technique than you. So you've got to be prepared to be surprised.
Yeah, that's, I like that. That's a good mindset to be in, that you got to always be on your toes, because yeah, you don't know what's going to come at you. It could come at any point. I mean, you may know, yeah, exactly, 90, be familiar with 90 or more percent of what's coming at you, but, you know, there's always going to be something that you're just not going to anticipate, that you got to be able to deal with.
Right. And gets back to the earlier comments that we both made about the counter for counter and the feel for the continuous motion, and that's just an additional way of expressing it, or a way that it comes out based upon that mindset.
Yeah, and that's that, the thing about that mindset too is that's definitely that old school, fighting mindset of, and that's when you can kind of tell who's been training with guys who are fighters versus, people with more just kind of a technique based and whatnot.
Yep.
That's that. When you're developing a fighter, you have to teach them, you have to root them in those basics of footwork and zones and techniques that are fighting techniques that are both defense, offense related, because there's no way to be able to, rip out an encyclopedia of techniques.
Right.
Exactly. So Rich, do you have any more interesting stories of Anton that Manon Ted relayed to you while training?
Well, I do, and it kind of crosses over to the modernist aspect as well. He made a comment about how Remy was willing to fight anybody. He used the term brass and male genitalia. He also confirmed stories that, like, when Remy would train with Anton, he would show up at the guy's house and he'd bring him a fifth of alcohol or whatever. And then when somebody else would show up for their pre-scheduled training time, Remy would say, let me go talk to them and find out what they want. And he would walk out to them and then tell them, Anton's not feeling well today, so would you like to reschedule? Yes, how about, tomorrow at Thursday? He'll get back with you. All right. So then he'd go back in and say, yeah, they're not feeling well. They want to reschedule tomorrow, Thursday afternoon. So he could get more time training with Anchai.
Nice.
It's an interesting aspect that, both Remy and Ted were, decent sized Filipinos, but not my size. Ted was probably 5'9", 5'10". Remy is, 5'10", 5'11", broader shoulders. But Anchan only came up to Ted's shoulders.
Yeah.
He was around 5'1", 5'2". And one of the things he used was his movement and his sensitivity of touch to guide the bigger people. There was a story he told of him and Ted and Anchan had gone to go see a fight. Somebody had challenged somebody. And one of the guys didn't show up. So the guy was all angry and mad. He did show up. He says, I'll fight anybody. I'll fight you all. And then he turned to Anchan and said, I'll even fight you. Well, Ted and Anshan didn't show up with sticks, you know, so they didn't have anything that they were used to fighting with or carrying. So somebody handed Anshan a standard pair of sticks, whereas he liked his grooved and or gripped, so it'd be easier for him to hang on to it. So the guy swings, he leans back, follows him back in, hits the guy so hard in the skull that he disarms himself.
Oh, jeez.
And as the guy is standing there half knocked out, half conscious, he jumps in and turns his elbow off to the side to keep his weapon hand pointed away from him and starts to like punch him. And a bunch of people jump in and like, no judo, this is just stick fighting.
What? Come on.
Now, there's probably friends of the guy who got hit.
Yeah.
Now that being said, there's another story of a fight with another guy who used 40-inch sticks.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Jeez, it's like a canoe paddle.
Yeah. And he was swinging them both, you know, across, and Anton leaned back, and the stick caught his mole on his forearm and ripped it off.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. And so on the next swing that came across, he jumped in, and when they got inside, it changed the whole dynamics because, you know, Anshan was used to being an inside fighter and the guy was used to being an outside fighter. And so it's, you know, I like those stories because it shows that they were human.
Yeah, and it turns out it was a good thing, too, because somebody picked up the mole, and it turned out, and they did a biopsy on it and ended up saving his life.
Yeah, I'm sure of that, yeah. So, you know, yeah, he had asked that. Now, I also know that when Ted left, Anshan was upset per Ted's discussions.
When he left to come to the U.S.?
Yeah, when he left to come to the U.S.
Yeah, okay.
And because he says, well, I was hoping you were going to take over for me.
Oh, wow, and, okay. So he kind of was pinning his future of the school on Hmong Ted staying.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, Arturo Sanchez, you know, stepped up and became his assistant and helped him a lot and taught as well, but usually Anshan was there. But the, you know, the mindset from that comes from that aspect of, you know, Ted feels the pride of that, doesn't take any disrespect away from, or doesn't mean disrespect or take any respect away from anybody else who had their own established schools, and they're now their own cousins for lineages. Then I know that he had asked me to also teach the same way he had taught me and the same way Anshan had taught him. I'm not saying I was the only one. I didn't clarify whether or not there were others. Ted was not somebody to write things down and give certificates or ranks. He was just somebody to allow people to figure out where you stood in the standing with others on your own.
And with that, so was it a kind of a, you know, the way you taught too, was it kind of that progression of, I teach you the stuff you need to know to get to the next level?
Yeah, he would always work on what you thought you needed to work on, and then he would, if not, we'd play with a little bit, and we'd work on some extra timing. But that's at the high level, right, where you're trying to fine-tune certain things. When you're still trying to figure things out, yeah, he'd be like, okay, we need to work on this next. We need to work on that next. And for a year and a half before his first stroke, I would spend at least one class out of every four going over a Abecedarium Sagittis and the basics with him and how he would teach it. And after about 6 months of that, he just said, Rich, why are we keep doing this? I said, because I want to teach this the right way. And so I'm watching you teach me, and, you know, and then he went, oh, okay, you teach me now. And then for the next year, once every 4 weeks or so, I would spend part of my class, anywhere from 15 minutes to a half an hour of my hour class, going over Abecedarium or Sagittis or a combination thereof, sometimes for a full hour with him to work on positioning and stepping and how does the teacher guide the student stick to put them in the right spot to help them make it easy to block.
Okay.
And so those were things that I know I worked on to help figure out that, which is why I think he asked me to, you know, teach for him, because I'm not sure everybody else did that portion of the homework. They may have just gotten the lessons themselves and figured out they had it, and some people probably do.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when you're talking about guiding the stick and all that, because, you know, going back to, you know, this exercise we do called Abierta Serrata, where it's an in-close, it's probably, I'm pretty sure it's based on, you know, a lot of some Balintawak concepts, but there's a lot of that where you're guiding your partner's stick, because your job is to make sure that they're in a good position while you're teaching them the basics of the move, going, you know, in and out of the checking and where they can go and building them up. So as when you're doing the feeding, you're also, you know, making sure that they're in proper positioning, they're blocking and things like that. And you know, so it's kind of neat to hear how, you know, some of the history kind of clashes back, because they're all from the same, you know, lineage. So.
Yeah.
So that's cool. All right. Well, hey, we're running up to the end of the hour here. We've been more than gracious with the stories and everything. John, you got anything else that you wanted to go through on your list?
On my list of questions? No, yeah. I think we went through them all, especially, you know, the stories of Anchong. I thought those were quite fascinating.
Those are good. So,
and also,
oh, go ahead.
And also the simple fact of, you know, as we all know, that in Filipino martial art, teaching usually ends up with story time as well.
No, exactly.
To actually prove a point.
So yes,
I actually have a standard. I tell people, I go, look, I have a private rate. Here's what it is. It's for an hour, but it's for the Filipino hour, which means it's an hour and a half to 2 hours. And they look at me, they go, what? I go, we'll get an hour's worth of training out of the hour and a half to 2 hours.
Yeah.
And after a while, they realize, oh, yeah, because there's story time and there's relational and explanation time as well. So that, you know, yeah. So I try to bake that into my understanding of private lessons. And
well, it's a good way to do it, too, because, you know, people get that, you know, that foundation behind it, and questions can be answered, and then you don't feel as pressured to fill the hour with, you know, tons of training, which is just going to fill anybody's brain up anyway with just too much. So I mean, there's only so much you can, you know, hammer into your brain without just, you know, constant repetition. So
and it also gives much context to what's happening.
Yeah.
And why you're doing what you're doing.
That's important. So, Rich, right now, I mean, what's kind of your, you have your school, you're doing seminars, what's going on in 2015?
15 or 16.
Or, sorry, well, yeah, I guess 2016. Yeah, this is we've hung our the sun is set on this year. So all right, fair enough.
I'll go out and see the in January, see the action martial arts events for Hall of Honors in Atlantic City. I like the events. I taught out there last year. Alan Goldberg's a nice host. It's a lot of good marketing with people. In March, we're discussing the plans for a Filipino trip right now. We'll be finalizing more probably next weekend with the group that's going. And I'm still on the fence, but I'm under 90% of going. They're visiting a couple different islands. There was an event that we were trying to be involved with, and they moved the location to a different island. So we have to decide whether or not we're going to be continuing with the event or whether or not we will just be visiting and teaching and or training with other people over there. Then there's I'll be in Buffalo at the end of April for Dr. Hartman's annual camp. And then in June, I believe there's a reunion camp here in the Detroit area that Bill Barker's hosting for Modern Arnis that I will be attending and teaching at as well. So I teach private through the week and classes on Sundays and Monday. And I'm currently looking at another location for a possibility of a class. So we'll see how it goes.
Wow. I'm tired just listening to that. that's a busy schedule. If students are looking for privates or to join classes, things like that, do you have a main website that we can put out for you?
Yes, bullettowalk.org.
All right, that's easy enough. Sounds good. All right, well, we'll do that. And, we thank you so much for having you on. We didn't really scratch the surface of everything you know, so it'd be nice if you had a good time. We could have you come back sometime next year. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. And with that, we'll close the show. FMATalkLive.com is where you can go to get all the information about the show. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/FMATalkLive. And then you can subscribe to us on Twitter. Follow us there at FMATalkLive. And if you have any questions or anything, shoot us a message on Facebook. It's a good way to get a hold of us. And if you want to get interested in any training, got John down in Chicago. He's Three Treasures. What's the official name of it again, John?
Three Treasures School of Arms.
There it is.
You can look it up on Facebook.
Yep. So there's that. He's out of Midway Coden Con. And that's the show. Thanks, everybody. Ingat.
Thank you.
Well, that's it, folks. Yet another episode of FMA Talk Live in the books. Thanks again for showing the true spirit of the Mandarigma and listening to another episode of FMA Talk Live. Please like our Facebook page, subscribe to us on Stitcher and iTunes. Also, follow us at #FMATalkLive on Twitter. And don't forget to check out www.FMATalkLive.com for all the latest and greatest on the show.